Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Welcome to episode 84 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly pop culture and current affairs podcast brought to you by journalist Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes. Welcome back.
Welcome back to you, Pish Pish.
Have you missed us? Have you missed me, Dolly?
I have missed you. It's nice to finally talk to you again because Pandora and I have it written into our respective contracts that we cannot communicate outside of recording time in the studio. Because the powers that be are worried about using up good material.
Good material.
So the only way that we can speak to each other is when there are two microphones turning over and Charlie Jones is present as a third party in the room.
Good material. I think that's being generous. Well, I haven't missed you as I've been listening to the glorious love stories.
Oh, thanks, Angel.
Anyone that's not familiar, that's Dolly's other podcast. She didn't think that the Hi-Lo was enough work, so she thought she'd do a whole nother one. But may I recommend, but actually both episodes so far of this series, very enjoyable. Stanley Tucci and Jesse Cave, absolutely obsessed with Matteo. That's an in-joke.
He's great. I really want to meet Matteo. This is Stanley Tucci's son. Listen to find out more.
And you're back this week with iCal, not to be confused with iCal.
Everything I know about love, yes. Back with a bang, not really. A bit tired this time round. Back with a feeble little... a feeble little beep. Yes, this is the only time I'm going to talk about it, and I promise I will not talk about that sodding book again.
So it's coming out in paperback. That's why you're doing another tour.
Coming out in paperback this Thursday with a brand new chapter on turning 30 and the meltdown that I had about getting older and confronting the inevitability of death and decay. And there are some jokes as well, and everything I know about love at 30. So yes, that's a brand new kind of section of the book that I would like you to read.
So desperate was I to read it that it came in its own Uber.
Oh yes, I put it in an Uber for Pandora.
There is nothing better than an Uber turning up and then you open like the door and on the back seat is either like a shoe you left behind that you suddenly realise you like desperately need
on,
for a meeting.
On a red velvet
or a book. Or it's just, as often the way with me, a set of keys dangled out the driver's window. So bloody
yes, I don't think that is the correct usage of Uber. But anyway, so yes, that's out.
I didn't even pull it. I couldn't risk that shit.
I felt quite mad coming out of my flat and just placing the paperback proof of my book
on
the back
plinth.
Seat for you. Also, just before we're accused of like extraordinary decadence, which that is, it's because Pandora very generously was quoting that chapter for something, so that's why
I didn't even quote that chapter.
Oh,
but
didn't.
Someone stolen my copy. No, I was quoting another lovely bit on love for a video that I was doing, which is coming out at some point soon, actually.
And also this week I'm published in France, Germany, Denmark, and I was also published in the Netherlands before Christmas, so please do buy those because no one knows who the fuck I am over there. That would be great. I'm also back on tour from Thursday and there are still tickets to see me in Exeter, Matinee in Brighton, Edinburgh, and I think that's it. Anyway, I'll do...
So those are the places where you're loved a little bit less?
Yeah, that literally, it really is obvious that no one knows who the fuck I am. It's very sobering. So, three tickets sold in Exeter, basically. That's my fucking home.
I'm laughing because I wasn't really sure if that was a kind thing to say.
No, it's true. There's nothing that's more confronting about how localised any vague readership is than doing a national tour. I'm very excited about buying a little book that you've written.
It was very generous of you to call it a book.
It is a little book, though.
It is a very little book. Yes, I've spent the last few months writing a long essay called The Authentic Lie for an independent crowdfunding publisher called The Pound Project. Some of you may remember that Dolly did this last year with a gorgeous little essay called Hopeless Romantic. And my essay, The Authentic Lie, starts crowdfunding today. I love the idea of The Pound Project ever since you did it.
It's such a good idea.
I'd really wanted to...
The ethos is about respecting both writers and readers. And basically you pay as little as £1 to have access to this beautiful essay. Haven't read it yet. Could be rubbish. Pretty sure it will be beautiful. And I can't wait to read the subject matter. I think is so, so timely for now as well. And you either have it in an audio copy or online, or you get these beautiful little booklets of the essay that come that I think makes such nice presents for people. So
they're the size of little wallpaper guides. Yeah. I used to collect wallpaper guides before I stopped buying city guides, because you can just go onto a hashtag on Instagram.
Yeah.
And they're the same size as those. So yeah, it's quite nice having little mini books. You can find the link on my Twitter and Instagram, but here it is as well. It's www.poundproject.co.uk. The Authentic Lie is about our modern obsession with authenticity, seeking it, anchoring it, framing it in a hyper-curated world. I look at womanhood, the internet, the self, bodies, celebrity culture, with the help of the words of lots of other brilliant writers, one of whom, Elizabeth Day, an award-winning author and friend of the Hilo, kindly wrote me a foreword, which is perhaps a reason to pledge £1 for my essay, even if you don't want to read what I have to say. You can just read what she has to say instead. Actually, I'm really proud of the essay, so let those be my last words on it, instead of some self-deprecating waffle about how you really shouldn't read it. God, women are the worst, aren't we?
Long-form essays. Really, really hard to do. And, oh, that's my tummy, sorry. Long-form essays, particularly long-form non-fiction, I think is really difficult. And it's so, so important to be discussing this right now, you know, with everything that's going on with visibility of intention online, etc., etc.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. While we're on the subject of paying for content, I would like to flag a fundraising page by Julia Kingsford and say thank you so much to Julia Kingsford for doing this on behalf of freelance writers and staff writers in this case. The Pool, which is an online women's magazine, which we regularly quote from and read from and talk about their articles on the show, has sadly gone into administration, which is incredibly sad, as it was a brilliant platform for...
My mother-in-law was just saying this morning how sad she was that it's gone, so it was very cross-generational.
Yeah, it was, and I think it was also just a great platform, uncensored, uninterrupted platform for young women. So it's very sad that a platform like that has been taken away. And what's even more sad is that it's folded while leaving thousands and thousands of pounds of debts to unpaid freelancers who have filed work and who are waiting to be paid. And the staff at the Pool were unpaid for a month.
Mm.
So this fundraising page was set up to raise some cash for basically all the free content we've been consuming, all of us, for a number of years.
Julia, who was like, I don't write at the Pool, I don't actually know anyone at the Pool, but I really liked it. She was like, I've put an arbitrary sum of 24 grand as the target because I know that 24 people work there. But, you know, so that's the idea that everyone, she was like, even though this will be woefully below what they're owed, at least everyone can have £1,000 each. But of course, I am sure it will surpass that. And also there's freelancers who, I know freelancers who's owed about £3,000.
And, I feel so strongly about this. I'm so, so lucky, just to lay my cards on the table now, I am so lucky that for the last 2 years I've been on a journalism contract. But, you know, for the best part of a decade, my life was spent ringing accounts departments of newspapers and magazines because I had no way of paying my rent. I remember literally being in floods of tears to a managing editor of a glossy magazine, crying on my living room floor and saying, you need to tell me what to do because my rent is going out tomorrow and this payment was going to be covering my rent and I've been chasing you for 3 months. I don't need your apologies. I need you to tell me what to do. And he had to personally transfer money to me, this managing editor. This is how bad it is. This is how bad it is. This is how little writers are respected. And this is how much that we think of writing as a self-indulgent hobby rather than a skill in a service. What I used to find insane about being a freelance journalist is you write the work. And, you know, writing is really difficult. I think people forget it takes a lot of concentration, just like any job, any skill that you have. It takes concentration, experience, and skill. And you do that, you file it, and then it was like that was half the job done. And then the second half of the job was going on this like Crystal Maze style quest.
Filling in the
of, like,
vendor forms.
Chasing the money. And it's almost like you were doing a tombola or something. And if you're lucky, you end up with the fee that you were
agreed. I had to fill in an online
form filling.
Tax survey for someone the other day to get paid. What the heck does that have to do with anything?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's deliberately obfuscating. The Hilo's wonderful editor, Anna, though, is doing something pretty great about it.
She is. She has started a campaign called hashtag Fair Pay for Freelancers, which is an open letter calling on the media industry to pay freelance journalists fairer, faster and better. The three things that she's asking of media companies is an end to payment on publication.
Yeah.
Respect to late payment fees and to update not fit for purpose payment systems, which is just like fair and basic and rudimentary. So we will link to that in the show notes because I think just today that campaign has gone live. And just a reminder before I finish ranting about it, some truly, truly brilliant writers wrote for The Pool, people who we've quoted and who have sparked discussions on this podcast, and I'm sure that they have made you think or sparked discussions in your
O'Donoghue,
life.
Caroline O'Donoghue, Stacey Buchanan.
Exactly. Robin Wilder. I mean, there are so, so many. Frankie Gradden, there are so many of these brilliant writers, Lauren Bravo, and I am so grateful for the writing that they provided. So if you feel the same, then please do donate to that page.
Support for the Hilo comes from my long-held favourite, the luxury professional hair care brand Kérastase. That isn't empty hyperbole. My hair was dry and frazzled thanks to years of hair colouring and straightening, and I was constantly dousing it in serum. And then I discovered Kérastase in my early 20s, and their masks honestly changed my hair's life. Happily for me, there's a whole new raft of products to let my hair live its best life.
Blonde Absolute is a new in-salon and at-home hair care range dedicated to blonde hair. As Pandora alludes to, when you have natural blonde hair like us, there are two essentials: repair to prevent dryness and tone neutralization to prevent brassiness. With Blonde Absolute, there is no need to compromise. It removes unwanted brassiness while strengthening and hydrating the hair, leaving it feeling soft and looking shiny. That is no mean feat when you colour your hair.
This customisable hair care range cares for all types of blondes, from sun-kissed highlights to balayage to all-over icy white tones. God, I love the word balayage.
So do I. Visit kérastase.co.uk for exclusive offers to celebrate the launch of new Blonde Absolute, available for a limited time only.
Thank you very much to our hair's friend for life, Kérastase. We're not going to catch up on all the news that titillated us over the last 6 weeks, because the semblance of that episode would be chaotic for CJ, to say the least.
In lieu of hard-hitting current affairs nous, and being the Hilo's resident press release discusser, I wanted to bring two to your attention, Pandora. The first is on the subject of daydreaming. New research has revealed that much of the nation spends 780 hours a year daydreaming at work, the equivalent of over a calendar month. 11:20 a.m. is daydream o'clock. Charlie looks like he's right there right now. And 780 hours a year is spent in daydreaming. Now, the reason I bring this up, I know it's a little bit whimsical and fey.
No, I forwarded it to you because I knew this was prime Dolly Alderton content.
Is I always worry that we have lost the skill of daydreaming and that we don't spend a lot of time daydreaming.
Because we go on Instagram
because
instead
we're always
and look at
on
other people's lives.
And I'm sorry to sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but it is something that worries me in terms of my own writing. I was listening to Wendy Cope's Desert Island Disc, which I'll be discussing later. And she said, you know, such an important part of writing is dream time. And I just don't allow myself any dream time because I'm so easily distracted now. And the minute that it's almost like I'm scared of where my thoughts and imagination will go in a way that I was so wild and free with my thoughts when I was a kid. Now it's like the minute I feel myself having a bit of space in my life to do that, immediately what I have to do is go on to like Topshop and see what's new in that week, or I have to go on Twitter and make some stupid joke. So I think it's good to know that the kind of art, and I'm now putting sort of systems in place in my life to try and force myself to start daydreaming.
I think you should do daydreaming
more.
O'clock.
Yeah.
I think you should set your alarm for 11:20 every day and have 10 minutes of daydreaming.
Are you a daydreamer?
I think I probably do more daydreaming than the average because I very rarely listen to music. I only
That's
ever listen
true.
To the old French chill or jazz on Spotify. So when I'm out and about, I occasionally listen to podcasts when I'm out and about, but I don't listen to podcasts nearly as much as you. When I'm out, that's when I do a lot of thinking. Mm-hmm. And because I haven't been a great sleeper over the last year or so, I do quite a lot of thinking in bed. You know, I'd never
but that's
my phone
not daydreaming. I know you and me and our disposition so well. That's frantic worrying.
Yes. No, I think I do daydreaming. I did loads on holiday. I literally felt like I'd done like almost like work, you know, when you're like, I've done so much dreaming. Mm. But I honestly think I'll do it too. Let's see if we can, I don't know, factor in 10 minutes a day. Although, again, knowing us, it will be like, it's 11:20, I have to daydream. Yeah.
My next survey is the places in the world that are most sung about. Can you guess what number one is, CJ?
I've just actually seen it. Sorry.
He's seen it in our notes. Sorry. Number one is New York.
I actually would have gone with Paris as number one.
I'm amazed at number two. Have you seen that on the set? Charlie, stop looking at Pandora's notes.
Sorry.
London calling. Ding, ding, ding.
London is number two. LA is number three. Paris number four.
What the
Miami
hell
number
am
five.
I doing drinking in LA? I used to think that was swimming in a lake.
Swimming in a lake. Number five, Miami. Pandora? Come on.
Will Smith.
Well done. Ah, number six, New Orleans. Number seven, Rome. I don't know any songs about Rome. Oh, well, oh no. Nothing.
I love that. Nothing. Nothing.
San Francisco, Memphis, Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, Compton. Oh, yeah.
Number
yeah,
18,
that makes sense.
Mumbai.
Tokyo, Houston, Las Vegas, Ibiza, Mumbai, Liverpool.
It gets quite low down though, Milan at 10 songs.
But it got me thinking about my favourite personal songs about places, and I've decided I'm going to make a little playlist.
Oh, you love making those playlists.
I do these weekly little playlists that no one listens to, so I thought I'd do one for...
I bet people do listen to them.
I think like 5 middle-aged men who follow me on Instagram do, I think. So I'm going to do one with all my favourite songs about places and link it in the show notes for no one to listen to.
Your favourite time-wasting activity, that. What do we have in the mailbag this week?
Dear Dolly and Pandora, this is from Lincolnshire. Happy New Year to you both. When I heard on the high-low that Pandora had acquired a real-life mailbag, I just couldn't resist the temptation to send you up-to-date pictures of your heifer namesakes. This is the person who named two of their calves after us. The bovine Dolly and Pandora are now almost 9 months old, and after a long summer in the fields, they're now back in the warmth of the barn for the
winter. Have a look at the pictures.
Oh my god, they are so cute. That annotation's a little bit bitchy.
What, you and your friend?
No, she's done a picture of Pandora, who's a gorgeous, like, caramel-coloured cow, who looks very velvety, and it says Pandora. And then there's a white one with its head firmly in the trough, and it says Dolly busy eating.
Look at the other one of you.
Pandora showing off her lovely bum.
Look at the other one.
There's the other one.
Oh, have you lost it? Oh, there's one of you, and it says Dolly in her fringe. I thought you thought that was a bit bitchy because it's just the cow with two pieces of hay, and I thought you'd be like, I know my fringe is sparse. Sometimes it just needs a little lift.
It is
just needs a little lift. It's not sparse.
Oh, they're so sweet.
I can't believe we've lost Dolly and her fringe.
They're back in the warmth of the barn for the winter. They spend a fair part of their day munching on silage, fermented grass, and
silage,
and rolled barley. Otherwise, they enjoy a spot of grooming, a fair amount of mooing, and they're really rather nosy and curious. Aww. As soon as they see one of us at the window, they're at the gate having a good look. That's like us, nosy and anxious. If they get another mention on the high-low, or perhaps the Evening Standard again, I'll be sure to let them know. And if at some point in the not-too-distant future you both fancied a farming special episode, do come and visit.
That's quite niche.
I'd love that. We'd love to have you here on the farm. With all the very best for 2019, and thank you both for being a guiding light and sprinkling a little joy into my life each week. From Jess. What a sweetheart. Thank you, Jess.
And so we'll try and put those pictures of Dolly and Pandora onto social media. for you all to have a look at. Some great stuff in the digital mailbag as well this week, as sifted through by our marvellous email editor, Anna. Highlights include a picture of a Hilo listener's toddler enjoying the best ever prawn sandwich.
From M&S.
A tale about a summer snog with David Ginola. No way of verifying that, but it's a very French story and there are cigarettes aplenty. A description of our voices. Dolly, yours is apparently buttery and smooth, and mine is like Cremant, bubbly and excitable. God, you sound so much cooler, Dolly. And a heads up about a rather cool resource called Quarter Life magazine that we thought would speak to a lot of our listeners who are having graduation blues or a post-uni panic about life.
Quarter Life magazine was set up by Joy and Emily to counteract the crisis experienced by 75% of young Brits. Unprepared for the realities of real life and work after university, and with only highly successful and untouchable people to look up to, Joy and Emily felt both confusion and painfully inadequate during this period. To quote them, they say, "It turned out we weren't alone. We found out using Instagram polls that only 50% of quarter lifers feel optimistic about their future, and 91% feel unprepared by the education system for real life and working in the real world. Also, 59% of uni graduates experience a deterioration in their mental health during the year after leaving uni, a year we have named the lost year." Jesus, I remember that.
I think that's really true.
Quarter Life features interviews with inspirational young startup founders like Freddie Blackett from Patch Plants, as well as first-hand personal pieces by quarter lifers pursuing their dreams and revealing their innermost struggles. What a great idea.
I think that's great. And we love Patch. I think we've both got our Christmas trees from Patch. Yeah. We thought we'd use this episode to discuss everything we've been reading, watching and listening to the last 6 weeks, as there's been rather a lot of good stuff. Well, we're not going to mention everything. We'll name check most things that we enjoyed and then talk about some things in more detail.
On you go, Panda.
Well, obviously we both watched the Fire Festival documentary on Netflix, so we're a better place to start than that. CJ's actually lobbying for Dolly to change her name to Dolly.
Up for it.
There have been a butt ton of pieces written about the Fire Festival documentary and the danger of influencer culture, which is, to be sure, pervasively dangerous, like many aspects of popular culture, but it's not, let's be clear, Jai Bolsonaro. And my favourite of these was Josh Glancy, who referred to Fire as a meretricious boondoggle.
I love Josh's writing. He's so, so brilliant.
A boondoggle is a wasteful or fraudulent project. Do you think there are people out there who are called the Hilo a boondoggle? It's best not to dwell.
Definitely. Yeah, it's best on the not iTunes dwell. Reviews. For anyone who isn't familiar with the story, Fire Festival was dreamt up by an entrepreneur who is now in prison for fraud. And it was meant to be the sort of greatest, most exclusive, most, you know, swishiest party of all time. And
on an island in the Bahamas.
And they spent so much money on kind of creating a fake party with the world's highest paid supermodels. They hired the supermodels, got a great kind of music video director, I think, or film director, to do this kind of small little film, like a package, to advertise the festival. And then it kind of created this Emperor's New Clothes.
Well, it literally didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
So not only did the tents not get built that were meant to be there, and the food, you know, didn't get bought in, but all those private houses that the models had been promised in order to come to hospital, they literally did not exist. There wasn't housing on that island.
But that's why I think it's very funny. It's like, it's tragic as well, but it is a sort of like faulty towers escapade.
But the whole thing was brought down with the sandwich.
Yeah.
It was the sandwich.
Because they were promised this like incredibly high-end
sushi feast.
Yeah, luxurious catering experience. And then someone put a picture up of this like floppy little bun with a piece of craft cheese resting on it.
One of my favourite memes, because that obviously is one of the ones that picked up, because I actually read this story in Vanity Fair 2 years ago, because Vanity Fair love covering kind of, you know, sort of failures of social culture and stuff, and I read it with great interest, so it's interesting now seeing it kind of covered much more mass than it was. But the other thing I loved about that is when a meme went round of this like sort of young good-looking guy beam on his face being like, "I had a great time at Fire Festival because I won my ticket and like a sweepstake at work, so I didn't spend any money and I got to watch really rich people have like the worst weekend."
because people had paid upwards of like $5,000,
and they were getting all these like really odd, because obviously Fire Festival desperately needed more money to try and build the festival. They were getting these really odd emails being like, you need to load $3,000 a day on your money band in order to be able to come. I mean, it's, you sort of can't really explain what it is until you watch it.
But it's a great metaphor for where we are in life now with the huge discrepancy between reality and the mirage that we see on social media. So that's what makes it feel kind of particularly poignant, I think. There's a breakout star of the Fire Festival documentary who was a guy called Andy King. He was part of the team that was setting
but
up.
But an innocent part of it, like a contractor.
Yeah, and he was called in by Billy as to sort of help, because they realised, as the festival was meant to be happening, the closer they got to it, they realised that they had no preparation, no experience, no funds.
In event.
And that this was not going to happen. So he called in, I think, his former employer, this lovely man called Andy King, and he came in to sort of help save the day. And then there's just this horrific moment
where it gets so bad that this is what he's been reduced to.
Where it's like the nadir of the whole planning of Fire Festival, where
the fuckedness.
Everything has fallen apart, all the catering, all the accommodation, everything. And Billy, for some reason, I mean, I have so many questions about how this was, how and why this was seen as the only option to save the day. But Andy, who is gay, Billy rang him and said, there was something to do with all the water wouldn't be released, all the Evian wouldn't be released. So he said, you have to go to the man who's in charge of releasing the Evian and give him a blowy.
That should be Evian's new slogan. What would you do for a cool glass of water?
There are so many brilliant memes. So, and this man, and he's almost like,
he laughs, he's like, I almost gave.
He's so flummoxed at himself as he's saying it. He's stunned by the memory. He's like, I went home and, he said, brushed my teeth and washed my hands and was fully prepared to go suck dick to release the Evian. It's extraordinary. Anyway, so he's now become, because he's so likeable, and he obviously was like just trying so hard to save
the day. I think he was sort of like, and is still completely bewildered how a kind of very, you know, successful event planner or whatever he, I know that's not what he precisely is, had suddenly become ensconced in this sort of nightmare of a drunk 24, I mean, Billy was passed out most of the time on the beach, a drunk 24-year-old and Ja Rule's making. I think he's probably like,
oh my god, can I ask one question about Ja Rule?
How did he get off the hook?
I actually am more interested, how did he fall in with such a wrong crowd? How did
Ja Rule?
Yeah, Ja Rule, how did he make friends with all that lot?
You make him sound like this, like, innocent schoolboy.
What happened to
Ja Rule? I like him describing himself as a hip-hop mogul.
Anyway, so Andy King has become this sort of beloved internet meme. And
you would find the one old-ish person on the documentary.
Oh, my God, I loved Andy King. But I actually think as well that, you know, why he considered doing such an extreme thing is that when he talked about Billy, it sounds like Billy was sort of his protégé.
Billy was like 24. Who puts faith in a 24-year-old to organise a multi-gazillion pound festival?
But Andy King has now become this kind of beloved internet meme. And he's also used his fame for good, as he has started a fundraising page to have all the fire employees, particularly in the Bahamas, paid, who have weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of unpaid labour.
Good for him. And the other great fundraiser that's been set up is by Marion Roll, the Bahamian caterer, who lost out on $50,000.
Oh, broke my heart.
I think a lot of people found that the saddest. But she's currently on over £125,000. So she's exceeded her target four times over. And I'm sure, because she seemed very civic-minded and, you know, community-orientated.
The reason she had to pay that money out, for anyone who hasn't watched it, is she had to pay her staff herself.
But I'm also sure once she hits a certain amount, she'll start divvying up with those unpaid labourers who were local men who were building for, you know, a month without getting paid. Question for you, because this is one that quite a few people have been talking about this week. Should Kendall and the other supermodels who promoted Fire Festival via just an orange blank square on their Instagram and got paid, I think she was paid the most at $250,000, should they donate their fee? Before you answer, because I feel like this is quite an important
factor in deciding. There was a FAR employee on the documentary that said, if we didn't know what on earth was going on as people that worked for FAR Festival,
they would have had no
why on earth should the models we hired know, and why should they be to blame for this? And also, it's quite kind of societally rote to blame, like, the young girl at the centre for, like, something much larger involving lots of men that's gone wrong. You know, how surprising that we're sort of reducing it to that. Mm. And if Gerald didn't know what was going on, to which I say, how the hell would Hailey Baldwin and Bella Hadid know what's going on? But anyway, what do you think? No, with that in mind.
I think that it would. It feels only fair that they should donate at least part of their fee, bearing in mind that they seem to be the only employees who were paid, and that their role, they still did work, they still deserve to be paid for work, understandably, but the work that they did seems fairly minimal in comparison to all the other labourers who've been left unpaid.
If I'm honest, I just think as a good PR exercise, apart from anything else, if I was their agents or publicist, I would say, but to Kendall, donate $50,000, start a fundraiser, put up one post on your Instagram, all your followers will have watched and really enjoyed Fire Festival, so it's not going to be any skin off your nose. Yeah, okay, 50 grand's a lot. Not if you've been paid 250 grand for an Instagram post that you then deleted. And honestly, like, I'm being like the cynical bit part of the publicist here, is it's good PR. Like, now it's really important to show yourself, to be like, philanthropic and all those things. If she wants to carry on, you know, building herself as a very influential young woman, that to me is the most obvious advice of all.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And on to another massively popular show.
Sex Education. God, it's brilliant. I watched the whole thing on a Sunday.
I read this morning that they had an intimacy director. Have you ever heard of an intimacy director?
No.
Is that a brilliant idea? That's apparently why the, you know, quite complex and kind of sensitive, especially when you're filming with adolescents and you're covering, like, quite explicit, very sort of sensitive, emotional things, whether it's, like, losing your virginity or a lesbian sex scene, which I think when you've got two young girls, you want it to be kind of honest, but not gratuitous. Do you know what I mean? There's like a particular tone that I imagine.
Yes, because you often only see lesbian sex through a male or pornographic gaze.
Yeah. And so anyway, so they had this intimacy director. For anyone that hasn't yet watched Sex Education, it is a kind of progressive, optimistic look at teenagers' sex lives set in a geographically ambiguous location.
It looks like a kind of American town. Well, it is. It's an American high school, and it has all the constructs of those American
varsity
teen movies
jackets
that
and
we know.
Cycling to school and not wearing school uniform. But there's English accents and lots of English pop culture references, like Wank and What's It.
It's weird because
not wanking on What's It.
Initially, that I found that kind of quite that inexplicable,
the cultural hybridity.
I found it quite strange, and it jarred initially. And then I was talking to my friend Lauren, who said she'd read an interview with the writer or director, and apparently it's because, and I do understand this, because there is such a treasured and nostalgic trope of the American teen movie that you associate those high school hallways and varsity jackets with excitement and sexiness and, you know, drama, whereas with anything that you suddenly put, you know, like bloody Grange Hill or whatever, whenever you put something in an English secondary school, fucking Skins, it just suddenly feels you want to get out of there. So I think it's a really clever trope of the show.
Like you, it really jarred with me. In the first episode, I thought, this is going to really fuck me off. But then I read two things. I read the piece Lauren was talking about, and then I read two other things that really resonated with me, which is one, that it was just like them being savvy. They wanted that cultural hybridity so that
Americans and Brits would be able to watch it.
Well, that's
it.
The thing with Netflix now as well.
That both of them would be able to, yeah, that both of them would be able to associate with it. And it's actually something that Porter magazine, Netta Porter's magazine, do that. They use American English, which sometimes I find quite jarring as an English reader, but they do it so that it's got, you know, more sort of mass appeal. The other thing, and this kind of has more, probably because it's slightly less cynical look at it, this has more truck with me, is that they kind of made, they plucked the best bits of all the cultures, you know, the sort of space and freedom of an American high school and the kind of relative independence of teenagers, or the look of the independence,
yeah,
with our kind of much warmer and nostalgic sort of
language. Yeah.
And apparently that's done to that magical realism is intentional, because the sex and the language around sex and the portrayal of sex and all of it, really, the whole show, is very optimistic. It's very progressive. I think that show will be what schools are like, hopefully, in 20, 30 years. You know, not, the attitudes are just not that evolved now. And so they wanted to match that kind of optimism with something really beautiful. And it's interesting because my best friend's watching it now and she's doing the turn that I did. She's halfway through and she's like, you know what? I'm starting to get really into this. Episode 8, I was hook, line and sinker, sort of really taking the baton for them and saying, well, why can't we have something positive? Why can't we have something optimistic that looks at sex and the way we discuss it and the way teenagers engage in it and just have this, like, it's just, it's joyful. It's really joyful.
For anyone not familiar with the plot, it's about a kind of geeky guy at school, a teenage boy who has his own kind of anxieties around sex. He is
played by the amazing Asa Butterfield.
He's the son of a very successful sex therapist played by Gillian Anderson, and she is incredible in the role, and she's very kind of earnest and funny, and she's kind of your worst nightmare as a sex positive mother when you're a teenager, where you just don't want to talk about sex to your parents at all. And him and his friends start to get access to her expertise through her work and her writing and her clients, and then him and his little friend make this kind of, you know, counselling therapy service for issues of sex and intimacy with all their school friends. So they all learn about sex in this very kind of positive, realistic, hopeful, progressive way. So that's what makes it feel kind of so different.
They're definitely having a lot more of it than most teenagers.
Oh my God. I mean, one thing that made me think, like, oh, I can watch this now and love it because I am a semi-sexually active 30-year-old woman.
If you watched that when you were
It would have made me feel really bad about myself, I think.
I also think, though,
Just to make that clear, that's not a criticism of sex education.
Yeah, that's not saying I shouldn't make it because of that.
I wish it had been around when I was younger, because I actually think the way that it talks about issues with sex, particularly with young women,
yeah,
I think
it took out so much shame,
would have really, really helped me. But just because I was thinking back to when I was a teenager, when I was like 15 or 16, I was having so little male attention. This show brought back this memory that I made up a boyfriend.
Were you the girl in the bum bag?
I made up a boyfriend and then created a Hotmail address for him and sent myself emails from him.
You were the girl who pulls out the string of Durex from her bum bag.
Oh yes, that is who I am. That's who I was. Also, my favourite character in Sex Education is Amy, who is just so cute and funny and sexy. I love her. And I did an Instagram story just saying I love this character and I love this actress. And it could be a chancer who's just lying. But a friend of hers replied and said, Amy's a good friend of mine and we both love the Hilo.
Isn't that nice? I love that. That is amazing.
What else have you been watching, Panda?
I really enjoyed Bohemian Rhapsody, which is the film about Queen.
Desperate to see that.
I absolutely love it. It's had not great reviews, actually, because I think people accused it of being too gentle and too sort of like... Basically, they're all really lovely to each other. It's really nice to see, in contrast to the Bross documentary, which people have been...
I still haven't watched them.
Oh my God, Dolly, you'll love it.
We'll get onto that because I want to hear your full report on the Bross documentary.
But in contrast to that, there was kind of... there is a central conflict between Freddie Mercury and the rest of the band members, but there's also this real, like, this unbelievable love and support for who Freddie is, especially as he, you know, realises he is a gay man. And the most amazing love story throughout it, actually, is the relationship he has with his ex-fiancée, Mary. They stay, like,
best friends, even when she has a baby and gets married to someone else. And they live opposite each other. And I absolutely loved it. You don't have to love Queen to go see it. It's fantastic. And also, I love that the two, him and Mary, the actors who play Mary and Freddie Mercury in the film are going out in real life.
Oh, how lovely.
I love it when that happens.
John Ronson did a very funny Twitter thread about that film where he said it's the worst film he's ever loved. So he said he knows that there are so many things wrong with it, but he just didn't care because he loved it so much. It made him feel so good.
It's also, it's a really funny script. Like, it's very witty in the sad bit. So there's a bit where Freddie Mercury tells the rest of the band that he has AIDS. And it's really, you know, it's really sad. But he says to them, you know, you mustn't cry. And he kind of gives them, he's like, let's take a moment to compose ourselves. And then there's just this bit where he says really waspishly, I just need to get my bitchy little vocal cords in order. And it's just filled with like really just great singers. I really loved it. And it's actually an incredibly feel-good film. Yeah. And I don't know, I think, and this is a whole different topic that I know, Dolly, you and I would love to dive into. Are we getting a bit obsessed with everything being completely factually correct to the letter? And like, is that getting in the way of kind of some artistic liberty, you know, for something to be portrayed as...
Well, it's not a documentary. It's a reimagining.
It's not a documentary. And I think that we need to be able to, like, allow some kind of room for manoeuvre in those stories when they're told cinematically. I mean, that's like with Sex Education, you know. Mm. It annoyed us both so much that this wasn't completely how we've seen it. Like, yeah. Why can't we allow ourselves to dream a bit? Mm. Why can't it be 11:20 a.m?
Because also there are things where truth is so vital and not telling that truth could create something very damaging. But a lot of time, narratively, it's not the most essential thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's important to know when truth-telling is vital and when you can leave room for, yeah, reimagining.
And then there's nothing that's sort of... it's not, like, obfuscating, but it's just an uplifting biopic.
Got to see it.
And the Bros documentary, which you have to watch. So, essentially... So, a lot of people will have seen this, I know, but for those that haven't, essentially what it was is it's a documentary about Luke and Matt Goss, who were in Bros together 25 years ago, twin brothers. They were like 19, 20, yeah. And it was, you know, it was huge in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think it was early 90s, actually, 25 years ago. And then they, you know, kind of fell out with each other and moved away and have done different things for 25 years. Luke's an actor and Matt has an incredibly successful show in Vegas. Anyway, they do this kind of reunion concert and so they do a documentary to go with it. And it is unbelievably honest about kind of the toxicity of their relationship, the emotional weight of being this hugely successful band together and of losing their mother, who they were very close to. They obviously really love each other, but God, they wind each other up. And why it has become so popular is because they are both very precious and they are both filled with the most inane, hilarious David Brentian phrases that are kept in completely, just kept in without comment.
Yeah.
So Luke will say, you know, talking about how hard it is to have a reunion tour, Rome wasn't built in a day, but we don't have the time that Rome had. And it's taking every metaphor and idiom. I think we're going to have to insert the bit about Conkers.
And now you can't even fucking play Conkers in England. Can we start a petition in on a Bros, please? Can we start an
honour?
How ridiculous it is that you can't play Conkers, and if you do, you've got to wear goggles. That is the biggest problem. Can't play Conkers in England.
I can live with it.
Dolly, you will love it.
I'm the last woman on earth not to watch it.
I think you might be the last woman on earth not to watch it. And trust me, you will so enjoy it. And they've had a real renaissance, I think, from it. And then I also watched... I'm mentioning these because they've had a lot of airtime. I'm not... So I know a lot of people have seen them. I'm not sure how much I thought either were great. I watched You.
Oh, which, it's about The Stalker.
Yeah, which is a series on Netflix based on a very popular book. Penn Badgley plays a stalker. I suppose we're meant to, but I found him utterly odious. I couldn't stop watching it, but I don't think I liked it. And if I'm honest, that seems to be the general consensus on this. Mm. That, like,
also try to be literary. So, like, the girl that he's obsessed with has a best friend who's called Peach Salinger. And yes, she's meant to be the granddaughter of J.D. Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye. And it's filled because the girl he's obsessed with is a writer. And, like, I think quite a crap writer. It's filled with, like, this very kind of pretentious rendering of New York. It all feels really laboured. I'd really love to hear more of what people thought of that, because it has been really popular, but I think it's riddled with flaws. And I've been watching season 6 of House of Cards.
Is this
without Kevin Spacey? And Claire Underwood is now president. And I don't want to give anything more away about it, but I think it's going to have to be the last series. I feel like it's eating itself. I feel like it's done what Homeland did, where people couldn't tell their elbow from their asshole by the end of it. Who was a terrorist and who wasn't? House of Cards is slightly doing that. What about you, Dol? What have been your highlights? Oh God, if you say Mary Poppins, it's like your Twitter timeline is sponsored by Emily Blunt right now.
Mary Poppins Returns has been the most, like, constant thing in my life since we last recorded.
Yeah, it's like you've had this torrid affair and I don't really know you anymore because I don't know Mary.
I have dreams about the characters.
How many times have you been there?
Went to see it at the cinema 3 times, and I'm seeing it again on Saturday for a 4th time at the cinema. I calculated nearly 7 hours of the last 3 weeks I've spent in the cinema watching Mary Poppins.
You have such an unhealthy relationship with things
sleep.
You enjoy.
I don't know why I have to do it. I have to do it. I have to make myself...
Do you then go off it afterwards, or do you hold it kind of in nostalgic? Like, when you come out the other side of Mary Poppins... Oof, that sounds nasty.
Oh, dearie.
Will you think of her fondly, or will you be like, can't touch her ever again, can't look at Emily Blunt in anything else?
No, I will always think of her fondly. I think I have to make myself almost ill with it to stop. So that's...
Do that ever happen with Wagamamas?
No, that will never happen with Wagamama.
God, she looked... for the listeners at home, you can't see... Dolly's face. She looked sort of revolted by that suggestion.
In fact, India, who is my friend, who's the only other person I know who's as obsessed as I am with, I guess, like, as sycophantic about things.
I love it. You just can't get it.
She's gone to... We've gone to see Mary Poppins Returns together twice. And the first time we went for a Wagamama afterwards, because it's our favourite restaurant on earth. Anyway, she talked less about Wagamama and more about why it's such a good
fun. They're not a sponsor, by the way.
So, I wish they were. I would serve Wagamama at my wedding, I think.
I wish you could get it as a takeaway.
You can on delivery.
No, I can't. I'm not serviced.
Oh, God, that's upsetting. It's so upsetting.
There are more... This is a bit like the Bros documentary bit with the Conkers. There are more upsetting things in my life.
So, Mary Poppins Returns, in all seriousness, if you are someone who loved Mary Poppins, I think for me it's very tied up with weird childhood stuff, because me and my brother watched it a lot when we were little. We were both two kids growing up in London. We both had nannies from when we were very little. There's a lot of personal stuff that's probably not addressed with me that means that I'm very attached to that film. And I think that it's the best example of a reimagining and a remake, because they respect the original film so much, but they still have all these twists on all the kind of set pieces, and there are these lovely little moments that kind of diehard fans of the original film will notice as a nod to the past. It's an incredibly moving film. I haven't seen it and not cried. All the songs, I've obviously listened to the soundtrack on repeat, and all the songs have these like, as a parent, Pandas, I think that if you were to watch it and listen to it and listen to the lyrics, you would be so comfortable with the idea of your kid learning about families and life and how to treat other people through these songs. There are so many beautiful philosophical messages within the film.
I'll definitely watch it when it comes out. I just can't get to the cinema very much. Because I do believe the power of those kind of films to tell larger stories.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I watched Trolls over Christmas and I was very moved by that.
Were you?
Yeah. There's a lot, again, it's like a kids' film that... Because kids' films do have, like, vast ambitions about the stories they're trying to tell.
And that does embed somewhere deep within you. Like, that does...
Well, it embedded very deeply within you.
I mean, when you're a kid. And actually, there's one moment at the end that I'm not going to say because I don't want to give a spoiler, but anyone who's watched it knows what I mean, where there's like a surprise cameo at the end that just makes me cry every single time, because it's such a beautiful comment on the passing of time. And passing of time just makes me fall apart. So Mary Poppins Returns, I adored. And I also loved listening to Emily Blunt be interviewed by Terry Gross on Fresh Air about a kind of her acting career, but she specifically talks about Mary Poppins Returns. It's a really, really great interview, and she talks a lot about how she kind of prepared for that role, not by watching the original film, because she didn't want to kind of do a bad impersonation of Julie Andrews, but by returning to the P.L. Travers books. And the original Mary Poppins is much crueler and much more vain.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that. Mm. Is her Mary Poppins tougher, or did she...
Yeah, tougher and more eye-rolly and far, far vainer. I think she does an incredible job. So, yes, that's all I'm going to say about Mary Poppins Returns for this week's episode. I also saw The Favourite, which is so good.
I loved Olivia Colman on Graham Norton's show talking about it.
She's brilliant. Olivia Colman plays, well, for me it was a little known monarch. Others may have known of Queen Anne, who is a fascinating character and had a very, very tragic life. But the story focuses more on a very interesting relationship she had with her sort of, forgive me, I don't know the correct word in like a regal sense, but like her right-hand woman.
Her lady-in-waiting?
Must be her lady-in-waiting, that was a very kind of hypercharged, kind of sexual relationship with really interesting power dynamics, and what happens, and that's played by Rachel Weisz, and the story follows what happens when Rachel Weisz's cousin, played by Emma Stone, comes in and kind of usurps that role. And then I listen to it's just brilliant. The way it's shot is really punk and cool and kind of grotesque and moving and visceral. It's totally brilliant and very affecting. And then I listened to her on David Tennant's new podcast, Olivia Colman, and she said one of the reasons she loved doing The Favourite is only in the land of films could she be able to pull both Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone, which I found very funny.
But it sounded hilarious. Like, Nicholas Holt said that for the first, like, 2 weeks of filming, they had to do the most extraordinary, like, games, like mind games and physical games.
Oh, really?
And it was just kind of completely absurd. And
it's got a surrealist quality to it. And
Olivia Colman was saying on the Graham Norton show that there's a bit, I haven't seen it, but there's a bit where Emma Stone's character fingers her character.
Oh, yes, I've heard this story.
And she put, and Olivia Colman, just for a lark, put a sponge at the top of her legs.
A damp sponge.
And when Emma Stone reached it, she shot across the room. She's really dirty, Olivia Colman. Yeah. Like, when you hear her talk, she is crude, yeah. Avatorial.
Yeah. Sure, I really, really like Olivia Colman. And this film is one to
brilliant.
Watch.
Well, Fleabag Series 2 is coming back, which means that Olivia Colman will be coming back in that amazing penis-obsessed, horrible stepmother role that she's so good at.
What have you been reading, Panda?
So I've been doing a lot of reading while the high-low is off, especially when I was on holiday for a couple of weeks. I read All That Man Is by David Cesari, which came out in 2016. It's 9 short stories about what it is to be a man and what it is to be disappointed in the male existence. I can't believe I haven't heard of him before. He's really accomplished, won a lot of prizes, and God, these are good. They're so good. I just ordered all his other work. They are extraordinarily detailed, yet extraordinarily spare at the same time. Kind of sparse and emotionless, but also hugely emotional at the same time, and evocative to read. Actually, he's not dissimilar in the way he writes and draws characters to Sally Rooney in his way of peeling back people with economy.
I think you'd love the way he writes, Dolly. Actually, they're...
Sounds very up my street.
Yeah, they're really brilliant short stories. And it is really important to read short stories about maleness. I would say that at the moment there are, and this is a good thing, a great thing, don't get me wrong, a lot of short stories about what it is to be a woman and the complexities of that. Mm. And I, for one, would always like to read more about what it is to be a man, because
I've got no idea. So he's a brilliant, brilliant writer, and I look forward to reading some more of his books on my bedside table. Speaking of what it is to be a woman, I read the number one bestseller in Ireland, Notes to Self by Emily Pine, which has just come out in the UK. Have you heard about this, doll?
No, I haven't.
I think we're going to see quite a lot of press on it. I think there's been a lot of hype because of its success in Ireland. It's six essays. Some are definitely stronger than others, but I particularly loved, and I think probably these were the ones that received the most critical praise, Notes on Intemperance, which is about Pine's alcoholic father, and the essay Speaking Not Speaking, which is about trauma and the truth of her wild child teenage years. I just wanted to read a little bit from Notes on Intemperance. It is hard to love an addict. Not only practically difficult in the picking up after them and the handling of those aspects of life they're not able for themselves, but metaphysically hard. It feels like bashing yourself against a wall. Not just your head, but your whole self. It makes your heart hard. Caught between endless ultimatums, stop drinking, and radical acceptance, I love you no matter what. The person who loves the addict exhausts and renews their love on a daily basis. I used to push myself to reject him, to walk away, failing each time. I oscillated between caring for the man who was afflicted with this terrible disease and attempting to protect myself from the emotional fallout of having an alcoholic father. It took years of refusing him empathy before I realised that the only person I was hurting was myself.
Mm.
You will love these essays.
Beautiful.
These essays and many essays or short stories that I read at the moment about, as we were saying, the female experience, are billed as being messy and raw. But I feel like that description is at risk of alienating people, as well as being almost quite predictable now as a descriptor. Like, women can only write about themselves messily. And it's also a really gendered way of describing books. Would Nausgaard, who writes extensively about his own self and life, be called messy and raw? No, absolutely not. And I actually wouldn't bill Notes to Self as that. What I would say is that they're really accessible, conversational, thoughtful essays. They deal with complex ideas because obviously women and humans and the human experience is complex, but they are not... they're not complex to actually digest. And I think that's a real feat. And I think that's probably why they have been so popular. And you can just rip through them. Another book I really enjoyed and thought was very thoughtful is Small Great Things by Jodie Picoult, which came out in 2017, which is another book from the Queen of Ethical Dilemma Fiction, as she's called, about a black nurse who is tending to a newborn white baby when his white supremacist parents order her to leave the room and say they want her to have nothing to do with their son. When their son in ICU suddenly takes a dip for the worst and sadly passes away, they blame the black nurse who was there at the time for not tending to him deliberately, even though she had been told exclusively to stay away from him. So it looks at all things, the loopholes and the pressures on the medical profession, race in America, obviously, the kind of white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan and the nuances within that community. She pulls at a lot of different strands. We talked about Spark of Light recently. Did you read that on your time?
Yeah, I read that while I was away and I really, really liked it. It's a book that opens at Mississippi's last remaining abortion clinic with a gunman who holds a number of people hostage who are all at the clinic for various different reasons, and the hostage negotiator happens to be the father of one of the teen hostages. It is quite a heavy and at times quite grim read, but incredibly compelling and a really interesting way of exploring all these various corners of debate in a kind of really well narrativized, compelling, page-turning
kind of
way.
As inclusive as she possibly can be as one author.
Yeah, totally. It's not judgmental, it's very fair. And it has that quality, her writing, where it is a real page-turner, but it isn't at the expense of the prose. It still has very kind of delicate and technicolor prose, which I think to do both of those things can be quite difficult.
I think the interesting thing about Jodie Picoult is she's a hugely successful author, particularly in the States, but she is
criticised quite a lot, and I think actually some of her literary achievements, the fact that her writing can be quite literary, is overlooked because her subject matter is often so thorny and so flammable. Yeah, politicised, that's right. That it's about as subtle as a sledgehammer, particularly when she talks about race, I think. And she does so much research, which I think is amazing, like interviews every time she writes on these, but she interviews hundreds of people, that she is at risk of trying to tick boxes because she's so desperate, and in a way that I think is truly admirable, so desperately trying to convey kind of a full picture and include as many people as possible in her writing. Roxane Gay reviewed Small Great Things for the New York Times, and one of the things I do when I read a book that I've really enjoyed, actually when I read any book, I go and read every single review out there to see what other people have said, because I just really enjoy people writing about books as much as I enjoy reading the actual book. And what she said, which I would expect perhaps people to respond for, this to be the response from people who have read the book, is that there is kind of, yeah, this checklist of issues that have to be mentioned, she feels, when she's writing a book about race. But Roxane Gay concedes, perhaps there has to be oodles of context and nuance when writing about the interior lives of black people for a mainly white audience.
Yeah, that's
very true. Jodi Picoult's audience is probably mainly white. And I don't think it's right that that's the case, but I think that she is right. And as Roxane Gay concludes, she'd rather read a book by an author who knew too much about the story she was trying to tell, even if at times it feels overwrought, than not enough. Mm. And it's also, it's a really pacey read. She's particularly good at courtroom scenes, I think. She's really good about the kind of legal dialogue. A couple of other books that I really enjoyed. Once More We Saw Stars, which is a memoir, kind of gets called a grief memoir, which I always think, again, is a bit pigeonholy. It's a memoir about what it's like to have loved and to have lost, essentially, by Jason Green, who's a writer in the States. I think he was a senior writer at Pitchfork. I don't know if he still is. It comes out later this year in the UK, and Christ, this undid me. I put it on my Instagram, and I actually Instagrammed one of my favourite bits in the book. He challenges a lot of the ideas about grief, and one of the things he challenges is the altruism of grief, that you're kind of this brave hero, and he says, you know, that fades, and he doesn't want it to fade. He wants, every time he walks through the door, for people to cheer him like he's a warrior from battle. He doesn't want to go back, he says, to the mundanity of like ordering a coffee and doing his tax return. He wants people to see him.
It's a very self-aware thing to
it is
to,
and
to
it's
describe.
And it's filled with stuff like this. It's so hard to read, it really is. And a couple of people in my life told me in no uncertain terms that they thought I was being a complete moron in reading it, because it is about a father who loses his young daughter, and the slightly odd coincidence of it is that his gorgeous daughter Greta looks very like my daughter. So reading this was honestly like actually very traumatizing, and I cried constantly for 3 days and slightly thought that I might not be able to make it through the book, but I was determined to, because I think it's really important to read stuff that really challenges you emotionally or otherwise. And it's a fucking brilliant book. Don't let the cheesy title put you off. It's a really important book, and I've just lent it to a friend of mine whose mother sadly passed away, because he travels through so many different stages of grief, and it's brilliant. And if you want to see the quote I love, I put it on my Instagram. And I also adored Becoming by Michelle Obama. Like,
oh, what's that like?
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, it has sold through the fucking roof.
I know.
Millions and millions and millions. It will be top of that bestseller list for, I reckon, ages. That was a really interesting sentence. That is my prediction. Ages. It will be there ages,
you
guys.
Heard it here first.
Ages. Like everyone I know who's read it, I adored it because it offers so much to so many different people. One person said, admiring me, that they didn't know it would be so literary. Her turn of phrase is beautiful. Like when she cycles through the seasons to talk about relationships. Another friend bought it as she's going through IVF, and the big sort of like spoiler of the book, to put it in quite crass terms, is that the Obamas had both of their daughters through IVF.
I had no idea.
No, neither did I. I loved it because it was extraordinarily candid about, and this is something that I would really struggle with, what it's like for your career and your marriage, for your own narrative to come second, not just to your husband's, but America. You know, Barack's kind of spirit for philanthropy, I suppose, for his mission, you know, which was there since she met him. This was not something that just just came into play when he became president, but she was always going to play second to this grand kind of ambition of his.
And yeah, that's quite a thing.
Fiercely accomplished woman, Michelle Obama. Both her and Barack quit this moneyed world of law where they were becoming incredibly successful to pursue roles in, you know, public service. And you just really feel like now is her time. Mm. She is going to be, I think, one of the most influential women in the world. I think she will be like Melinda Gates. I think she will be, who obviously does incredible philanthropic work with Bill Gates. I think she will be like Oprah. I think she will be like, who are other women doing freaking amazing stuff in the world? She'll be one of them. So that's what I would say about Becoming. It will be on the bestseller list for ages, and that she will be one of them. One of them successful women. Now give me some of yours, Dol.
I am shouting from the rooftops to anyone who will listen about the book Ordinary People by Diana Evans.
Oh, God, I made her bring it for me today because she would not stop banging
it's
on about this.
So good. Not to be confused with Normal People by Sally Rooney, which is also very,
when you
very
told
brilliant.
Me you'd enjoyed it, I was like a bit like, Dolly, I know you really love books, but actually it's called Normal People by Sally Rooney.
Normal People is brilliant, and we discussed a while back. Ordinary People by Diana Evans is a very different story, and it's so, so good. I really encourage anyone who is looking for a good book to pre-order it now. We'll put
that's
the pre-order.
A bit, that's a bit like me saying that it will be in the bestseller list for you. If you're looking for a good book, just a good book.
No, as in because I think that people don't realise the power of pre-order. And
totally.
For selling power for people
we're
buying
books. We're big on pre-orders here.
Yeah, because it makes such a difference for bookshops ordering from warehouses and stuff. So just, if you like the sound of this book, go pre-order it, and then the day that it's published it will land on your doorstep.
It is a good
how
book.
Wonderful. It's about two sets of couples who find themselves at respective moments of crisis in their relationship and in their lives, set around the time of Obama's election. It's called Ordinary People for two reasons. First of all, the John Legend's kind of defining album, of which that was one of the kind of most listened to tracks of the time, is a really beautiful soundtrack to the whole book, and kind of almost, not dictates, but it kind of helps shape different stories and different themes of the book as you read it. It's also called Ordinary People because it's a decidedly unromantic view of long-term love. It's a very kind of realistic and funny and very sad and often sort of deeply existential look at the compromises that you have to make when you choose to be in a long-term relationship, and particularly choose to have a family. What you give up, what you gain, the reality of long-term monogamy and kind of having security of a unit and a family, what you have to give up for that. Mm. Ego, vanity, spontaneity, romance, often a sense of freedom, and it's about kind of facing the reality of saying goodbye to those other things. And also something that I think people don't talk about a lot about getting married, falling in love, meeting your person, having children, is that because that's often the end of the story for people. That's the
you never
happy ending.
Talk about what happens next.
No, and yeah. And actually, like, there's something that I think that certainly I anticipate might happen for me. There's something that I think people are afraid to talk about because it makes you seem ungrateful or like you're tempting fate or something. But there is something very, very sad about getting everything you want in your mid-30s or 40 or whatever. Because, well, what is there after that? And of course, there are many, many, many other things. There are great many other experiences and riches of life. But something that's not, I think we're so scared of looking at, is for a lot of people that is the sublime ending. And when you get it, you have like another half of life to live. What the fuck do you dream of? So it's, I mean, even talking about it now, it is, I found it very confronting, and I found it very, it was so truthful it almost winded me. But it's weirdly not nihilistic. It's really very, very hopeful and very moving and just full of real life and such a full portrayal of what everyday life is for the majority of people who make a choice to settle down, for want of a better phrase. And also it's a great exploration into black identity and the black experience that is very much a theme of the book. And I read somewhere that the author, Diana Evans, wanted to explore blackness without it being
the primary theme of the book.
Yeah, and without it being tinged with a tragedy that you often understandably read about when you read about the black experience in this country or in America. And it's more about telling stories of the lives of black people in the way that we often so read about white people, which is more in an everyday way, in a domestic way, in a romantic way, in a quotidian way, as well as the kind of socio-political stuff bubbling underneath. So it's just so fucking good.
Wait to read that. There was a bit where you said there about the way in which it talks about the black experience, which reminds me of a book that I absolutely loved that I read last year called The Mothers by Britt Bennett, which I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend if you like kind of familial dynamic stuff about community, like kind of Meg Wolitzer type of
community.
Is it similar to Meg Wolitzer, or very, like, would you draw any kind of
I've never read prose quite like hers.
Oh my god, I can't wait.
Pandora's got my copy that I took on holiday when I was on my own, so I've already warned her that it's splattered with Tequila Sunrise.
I said it's gonna kill me. It's all remnants of sort of sunny meals, and now we're in dark and depressing London. Let's cycle through your other loves.
I also loved Swan Song by Kelly Greenberg Jeffcott. God, I love this book. This is a reimagining of real life incidents, all based around the writer Truman Capote, who wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's and who was a kind of celebrated bon viveur of Manhattan, upper echelons of glamour and wealth and excitement and culture and the literary scene of the 50s and 60s.
Awesome.
And it's about how he befriends a group of beautiful Manhattan socialites who he calls his swans. And it tells all the stories of his swans and the years that they spent together having various lunches and going to various parties in Manhattan. And they would tell him all their secrets. And it's about the real life incident of when Truman Capote, having gained their trust and their love and friendship for decades, wrote a huge expose about them.
That sounds great. I mean, I loved In Cold Blood. And I think often what people do...
Oh, it's a lot about In Cold Blood
as well. And also, like, Truman Capote, like, a shady man. His ethics were like not nice. So
yeah,
he's often kind of revered without the context, I think.
I think, well, what's interesting is that this book really, it's a big, big book, and it goes into the complexities of him and his tragic childhood, and yeah, it's just, it's so, so good. I loved it, and particularly if you're into kind of 50s and 60s Manhattan culture, which I am, like, there's lots of these lovely sort of whispered asides about the Kennedys and stuff. It's just great. So it's a reimagining of a real life incident. Mm-hmm. I also loved, and I've listened to it twice and told everyone about it, the Origins podcast, which is an American podcast that is so rigorous. It's like a super analytical dive into certain moments of culture. And there is a 3-episode strong series, which is an analysis of Sex and the City.
My God, your recommendations are like making me dribble.
This is so good. And they talk to all the main cast members other than Kim Cattrall, and Kim Cattrall gets a little bit of a evisceration in the last episode. And they talk to Candice Bushnell, they talk to Darren Star, they talk to Michael Patrick King, basically everyone who created that show. They do a deep dive of analysis of how they created it, and it's so good. My favourite person is Chris Noth, who just seems to hate the show, even though he does so with sort of a sort of affection, but he says things like he just hated how materialistic it was. He said in the end he felt that the clothes became the tail that wagged the dog, and he felt like it turned into a costume drama.
That's sort of true. Ollie and I realised that we'd never watched Sex and the City 2. You know, the one about Abu Dhabi. Mm. It's absolutely hilarious. We didn't finish it. We just watched a bit.
I read Putney on your recommendation by Sofka Zinoviev. I loved it.
Putney, as some of you may remember when I talked about it on the Hilo, is about a girl who had a relationship with a friend of her father's when she was underage. And
very, very,
very underage. And it's looking back at that relationship in hindsight and how you retell stories and how you tell stories and lies to yourself. So it's kind of a lot about storytelling as well as kind of obviously
consent. Yeah. And it's also set in 70s London, and a lot of it is an examination of a culture that people talk about in the 70s in particular in a way that sometimes irritates me, because it wasn't like ancient Greece, to quote my friend Ed Cribbs.
I love when you say that.
Like, it was this orgiastic time of, like, you know, total zero morality, which just isn't true. But there is an interesting, insidious culture of that time, particularly around gender, that she kind of explores. And I found it a really, really interesting and truthful exploration as to why someone who has been abused might for a while feel a level of Stockholm syndrome to the person they felt loved them. And that's an uncomfortable thing to go to dig into in a story. It's very, very brave of her to look into those kind of uncomfortable, distasteful truths. So I really, really enjoyed that. Fellow fans of Nora Ephron, I found a brilliant kind of consolidated selection of the best long reads online about or by Nora Ephron, which I will link to in the show notes. And it took me to a brilliant piece on Vanity Fair, which is the oral history of You've Got Mail, and the directors and the writers and the actors all talking about what it was like to make that film. And I love that film. I think it's the perfect rom-com. So that was a lovely, lovely read. I adored Lauren Bravo for Foodism, speaking about traditional food of love for Valentine's Day. She's one of my favourite people to read on the subject of food, and this article is as evocative and lyrical and moving and funny as she always is. Here's a quote that I particularly loved. "Ask around, as I've spent the past week doing, and it becomes clear that properly romantic food is the stuff of spontaneous picnics, not exorbitant set menus. It's the bacon sandwich lovingly presented to soothe the hangover you haven't admitted you had yet. It's somebody yelling, 'Wait, the garnish!' and lavishing a fistful of coriander on top of your TV dinner. It's a bowl of noodles thrumming with garlic, safe in the knowledge that if you both eat them, you can still snog afterwards. And it's ducking out of the rain and into some backstreet bistro with white clean tablecloths that you will refer to ever after as that little place we love, even though you've never actually gone back. Of course, food evolves as relationships do. Over time, individual soufflés give way to ice cream on the sofa, two spoons doing battle for the last chunk. Sexy lingerie is replaced by trussed-up chicken. Your heart melts instead at the sight of late-night leftovers with a plate on top to keep them warm. At some point, you will eat dinner in a bare room using two cardboard boxes pushed together as a table, and it will feel like the most exquisite meal you've ever had."
You write very similarly, Lauren.
I wish I wrote like Lauren Bravo. I think she's brilliant.
That's the highest compliment of all.
I loved listening to the poet Wendy Cope on Desert Island Discs, and I'm very sad to say that I haven't been hugely familiar with her work up until now. I think actually on a Hilo episode, ages and ages ago, I read a poem called On Waterloo Bridge, which is the only poem of hers that I knew and loved. But it's her Desert Island Disc is beautiful, and she's so honest and talks about very kind of uncomfortable things, including the difficult relationship which she had with her mother, and how people in the world of poetry are incredibly kind of snobbish around her work. And it's opened up a whole new world of Wendy Cope poetry for me that I love. The Orange by Wendy Cope. "At lunchtime, I bought a huge orange. The size of it made us all laugh. I peeled it and shared it with Robert and Dave. They got quarters and I had a half. And that orange, it made me so happy, as ordinary things often do just lately. The shopping, a walk in the park. This is peace and contentment. It's new. The rest of the day was quite easy. I did all my jobs on the list and enjoyed them and had some time over. I love you. I'm glad I exist."
Oh, that is
Isn't that
lovely.
Beautiful? Just about kind of reveling in, you know, the joy of everyday things.
Yeah.
What else have you been enjoying?
I read My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Atessa Moshfegh.
You
read that, right?
I found it catatonically depressing, but I loved it.
It's a strange book. I mean, she's definitely polarising.
She's got a new essay out in Granta, which I'd love to read. I just took out a subscription to the Paris Review, which I'm so excited about because a lot of my favourite authors have written essays for the Paris Review. Sally Rooney's written one. Mm-hmm. Isabella Hammam, who has just written The Parisian, which has had a lot of kind of pre-hype. I mentioned it in our essay before we went on a break. Haven't got around to it yet because it's a big book. But anyway, I wanted to dive into that. I'd also love to take out a subscription to Granta, but, you know, these things cost money. Anyway, she's written a Granta essay about a sexual experience she had when she was a teenager, and, you know, an inappropriate sexual experience she had, but the power of women. And she has said, you know, I think the great thing about all the stories we're telling at the moment about women and kind of sexual experiences they have is that we need to be able to tell different kinds of stories. So it sounds like it's probably quite a controversial essay.
Yes.
But I look forward to reading that because I think there's, you know, absolutely room for, and safe, should be, all perspectives.
And safe in her hands as well, I think. She's a bold, bold writer.
It is, yes. It's an odd book. I wouldn't say it's for everyone. It is, yeah, catatonically depressing, oddly moving by the end, because she's, not a likeable, not a likeable protagonist. But anyway, interesting book. I'd quite like to read Eileen, which is what she shot to fame with, but apparently that's even more hard to read. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say I won't. I am currently reading, and I am loving it, Duped by Abby Ellen. I have learnt so much. It's based on a true story by the New York Times journalist Abby Ellen, and she told it recently. I think she'd been in the Times, Telegraph, New York Times. She basically fell in love with a man that she calls the Commander, who was not who he said he was. You know, he said he was sort of a CIA spy and all these things. Anyway, she found out after a year that it was all a complete lie, and she was engaged to him. And she's like, how does a kind of intelligent investigative journalist like myself get duped? And it looks into all kinds of deception. It, you know, from the fudge factor, as she calls it, which is the idea that 15% of us lie all the time, to the deceit continuum, to imposterism, emotional fraud, cognitive dissonance, living double lives, tons of fascinating case studies.
I'd love to read that.
Oodles of other books, specialists, very witty and readable. It's something we read about time and time again, and we actually cover it on the Hilo fairly regularly. Anna Delvey, Belle Gibson, Rachel Dolezal, people telling, you know, grand lies about their life. And then it's also white collar crime, like the Ponzi schemes, Bernie Madoff, men with multiple families, more typically men than women, she says. Not to say it's not sometimes women, but it is more typically men. It's Fire Festival, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly.
There was just this one bit that I wanted to read out. The more I listened, the more questions I had. Questions about why is this happening? Why do we keep hearing these kinds of stories now? Is it because, as a culture, we talk more about deception than we used to? Or are there more pathological liars lurking about? Is it simply fear of missing out that propels people to do whatever they want, others be damned? Does the internet, with its alibi networks and untraceable Bitcoin and disposable prepaid credit cards, make it easier to pretend to be someone else? And there's lots and lots of kind of exploratory and observational and anecdotal narrative in there. You know, it's interesting Mrs. Wilson.
Time. Yes, exactly. It's such an interesting time as well to be talking about our relationship with the truth, because I just think the truth, it's kind of, you know, semantic meaning. It's just shifting.
That was really interesting to me writing this essay about authenticity. There are bits that I've taken from what she was talking about truth and the role it plays and how that relates to authenticity.
How we value it now, which is not that much.
And how we live our lives. Well, we think we value it a lot.
Yeah.
Another weepy I enjoyed was The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which has been a massive bestseller. Yeah. It tells the true story of Lael and Gita, who met at Auschwitz, Birkenau, the concentration camp, in 1942, came out a year ago, and again has been on the bestseller list for ages. The truth of it has been called into question, which is sad but perhaps inevitable. Heather Morris, the author, defended it as not as the story about the Holocaust, but a story.
Yes, exactly. I think that's such an important thing to point out.
And she spoke extensively with Lael about his life over 3 years. It was originally a screenplay, actually, before she turned it into a book. I think with a piece of history as sensitive as that, it's always probably going to be ripe ground for criticism. So I think it isn't surprising
surprising that there have been people that have refuted, you know, claims in it. But it's a, again, you know, it's a devastating but really uplifting thing. And as I said earlier about reading Jason Green's memoir, just because things aren't easy to read doesn't mean we shouldn't read them. Lastly, Vox by Christina Daucher came out last year.
Oh, I read that while I was away.
Did you?
Yeah.
I enjoyed this. I'd kind of, you know, stalled reading it. Another piece of dystopian feminist literature, and I thought, do I sort of want to read another thing like this right now? It's about women who are limited in how many words they can use a day.
The premise is brilliant.
It's very Handmaid's Tale. I found it actually, more than anything else I've read with this kind of dystopian distofem lit, as I call it, I found it impossible while reading it not to imagine it on TV. It did feel
so funny you should say that, because that what I took from it is when I read it, it was like reading a screenplay.
Yeah, I think
I
it would
feel like I was reading prose,
and it did really feel like Handmaid's Tale. I really saw it on screen in that way. But I think she did manage to create something entirely new with that sort of idea. I read a great piece on Vulture about why we are so obsessed with the dystopian right now and what it says about the lives we are living, and it's really interesting. And I will try and remember to link that in the show notes. What about you, Dol? What else have you loved?
I read a lovely and funny and sad and informative book called Bottled Goods by Sophie Van Llewellyn, which is quite a short story about a woman living in communist Romania whose brother-in-law defects to the West, and the knock-on effect that that has on her life and the life of her husband and family.
Well,
and
you don't you normally read it from the escapee,
and
not the left behind.
It's got this kind of lovely, almost magical, well, there is a kind of very surreal twist at the end that weirdly I felt so on board with when it arrived, but it almost reads like a sort of Wes Anderson film, because it the story is told in almost vignettes, and it's just really quick and enjoyable to read about a world that I know very little about, so I was very grateful to kind of be more illuminated on it. And it was, yeah, it's just a really enjoyable read, so I loved that. I listened to Alison Janney on WTF with Marc Maron, and I think it's one of his best ones.
I love
actually.
Alison Janney.
She is such a chick. She's like the coolest person I think I've ever listened to in an interview.
What's she been in since the...
She was in I, Tonya, Lady Bird, Drop Dead Gorgeous, one of my favourite films, Juno. But the reason she's so interesting, first of all, she's just like a fucking rock star.
Yeah, she's badass.
She does not give a shit what people think of her. And it's not, but it's so charming and it's not affected. And you can still tell that she's like such a truly decent person. Like one of the first things she says is, she's like, oh, I'm really worried about this interview. And Mark's like, why? And Mark is so into her. And she says, oh, I'm just not a very good talker. I'm very good at listening. And like, I really believed her when she said that. She obviously just feels like in life she's someone who's much better at absorbing rather than transmitting. Mm. So she's not, you know, unlike yours truly, she's not someone who kind of likes the sound of her own voice. You can really tell that when she's speaking and when she's telling stories. And she talks a lot about what it's like to have late life success. I mean, she was in her late 30s, which is not late life success, but in the world of acting, it really is. And about kind of how she knew that the certain look that she has. Also, I had no idea she's 6 foot. That she said that she knew it would only make sense once she was out of romantic lead or ingenue territory. But it meant that she had this, like, her life's been in two halves because she didn't arrive to acting until that point. Mm. So highly recommend that. Really funny, interesting, honest interview. My beloved Diana Athill died while we were away. Anyone who doesn't know Diana Athill, she was a publishing genius. She published the likes of Philip Roth and Margaret Atwood. I think she was 101 when she died, and she was writing right up until she died from her nursing home in Highgate. Louisa McGilligoddy, who is an editor at Style, did a lovely tweet where she said that, I think a couple of years ago, Diana Athill wrote a piece for Style, and she said that she wrote all of it by hand and sent it in the post from her nursing home in Highgate. And she's someone who is known for her memoir writing. She wrote a series of memoirs when her kind of publishing career finished, about her life, and she is brutally honest. I read a lot of her and listened to a lot of her when I was writing Everything I Know About Love, because I wanted to remind myself of how important it is to be brave when you're writing the truth about yourself, because she really is a pioneer for that. And she talks about and writes about the most fundamental and simple truths, like the most basic truths, with such precise and elegant prose, but makes you think about these truths in a new way.
Well, she was a hugely privileged woman, but she was very liberal, you know, her ideas about private school or about privilege. And I think that's what you Instagrammed, didn't you, is her on privileges. She did not write or think or live the life that those from her background or her peers would expect her to have, and that's what made her, I think, a brilliant writer.
Yeah, exactly. And she, there are so many, when she died, there were so many pieces last week that ran all these beautiful nuggets of wisdom for anyone who wants to explore her writing. I have to say, actually, the way that I discovered her was through a Lenny Letter piece, where one of the Lenny Letter writers went and interviewed Diana Athill.
R.I.P. as well.
Yeah, but that can be read online in the archive. The piece she wrote for Style is again a couple of years ago, is very brilliant. Her Desert Island Discs is a beautiful, beautiful episode. And The Telegraph last week ran a piece of some of her best bits of wisdom, which I'd like to share with you now. She said, "Enjoy yourself as much as you can without doing any damage to other people. I write for fun rather than to cure myself of something, and that was a very nice discovery I made in my 80s. I felt like that really rang true for me, that kind of that mission of exploration rather than to kind of come up with some true, you know, divine truth about herself or about life. I think sometimes writers put too much pressure on themselves to do that. She said, this is kind of her more old-fashioned take on the idea of mindfulness. She said, looking at things is never time wasted. If your children want to stand and stare, let them. When I was marvelling at the beauty of a painting or enjoying a great view, it did not occur to me that the experience, however intense, would be of value many years later. But there it has remained. And finally, something she said that I just think is so important, I'm trying to hold so close to my heart right now in my life, and I've written it out and put it on my wall. She said, generally office and home were far apart, and home was much more important than office. I was not ashamed of valuing my private life more highly than my work. That, to my mind, is what everyone ought to do.
Oh, lovely. And I love that you've written it out, and that seems a very nice note to end the Hi-Lo on. Thank you so much for listening to the Hi-Lo. You can rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps other people find us and boosts us in the charts. You can tweet us at the Hi-Lo Show and email us thehiloshow@gmail.com, and if you tweet or email us to ask where the show notes are, we won't reply and we will put our head down the loo. And you can write to us to get into the physical ye olde mailbag at Grace O'Leary at Independent Talent, and we will put the address to that as well in the show notes. I really hope we remember to put everything in the show notes that we've said we'll put in the show notes, but if we don't put it in the show notes, you'll be sure to tell us. Bye bye.
I'm sorry to do this. We are going to play out with Mary Poppins Returns. And if you don't believe, just hang on to my sleeve.
Forever is now,
and there's nowhere to go but up, up. There's nowhere to go but up.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1.
Only from Rust-Oleum.